came here to do a podcast and chew bubble gum, and I'm all out of gum. Hello, and welcome to episode 146 of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we and other shady background figures interrogate films previously described by the establishment as masterpieces.
Kick ass.
I am Nick, the shades-wearing cool dude who has had the veil lifted from his eyes of the podcast. And I am joined, as ever, by Roger.
I'm not sure who that leaves me to be, but everybody else, I guess.
And we are discussing, we can't resist it, another John Carpenter film. I think we will do his whole oeuvre at some point. But if you hadn't guessed from the intro, or indeed from the title of the podcast, we are discussing 1988, is it? They Live.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, well, there we go. That was our short podcast. We're generally very impressed with the versatility of John Carpenter. I suppose this one is slightly close to another of his, which is it's a bit Big Trouble in Little China, in that it's sort of an action adventure with a supernatural, or at least science fiction, yeah, bent in this.
I found it quite odd because, generally speaking, when we've viewed a film that I've watched before, I've felt more or less the way I felt about it when I first saw it. You know,
interesting.
I'm however many years older, I hope my critical faculties have matured somewhat, but broadly I tend to like the things I liked and dislike the things I disliked. And this is one that I loved when I first saw it, but I didn't hate it this time, but it felt as if it were falling quite flat. So I hope we can.
It's interesting you said this is my first time watching They Live, and I was fully prepared to have the time of my life. And I didn't quite. So we can discuss why. So the premise of the film is,
there's the guy.
We have Rowdy Roddy Piper, ex WrestleMania. Is it WrestleMania? I think it probably is WrestleMania, a very famous wrestler. You may notice that I don't follow wrestling.
Yeah, I believe he was still active in wrestling at the time. He gradually retired. You don't have a single retirement from wrestling. You have comebacks and things, but he was still active in the field when he made this.
You get to a point where you need to branch out into something else.
The knees, they just go.
Exactly. So he plays a down and out, homeless construction. Well, he's not really. He becomes a construction worker, but he will do anything.
Well, in the strict taxonomy, he is a hobo. He is traveling looking for work.
Certainly not the littlest hobo, though.
As opposed to the tramp who is travelling but not looking for work, and the bum who is neither.
But I didn't realise there was a taxonomy of bums. But
yeah,
yes,
I mean, these terms all used to have specific meanings, because it's basically your seasonal labour guys. I mean, so you remember when we watched Nomadland, they're basically doing the hobo thing. They are travelling in search of seasonal work.
Hmm. But they're taking their homes with them in that case.
Yeah, but yeah, and he turns up off the train, and why is he here specifically? Not particularly clear, but you know, it's a big city and he's hoping for work.
Now, the whole John Carpenter usually does his own soundtracks because he's a very good composer in his own right. Here, the great part of the film is suffused with kind of a bluesy, jazzy rhythm. Now, normally straight jazz just turns me off. I don't mind this kind of bluesy, what would you call it, bluegrass kind of rhythm. Mm. But it goes on a lot of that kind of boom, 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 boom.
And it all sounds pretty similar to me. I mean, yeah, here's the harmonica again. There is a soundtrack album. The 20th anniversary edition has 29 tracks, so, you know. Clearly, there is more than the single refrain, but sometimes when I was watching it, it felt that way.
It had a touch of the last goodbye to me, or the long goodbye, where it's all you hear in the whole film. Normally, I mean, we both thoroughly enjoyed some of John Carpenter's soundtracks, particularly Assault on Precinct 13. I really liked The Thing. I didn't dislike it, but it became repetitive and a bit irritating.
It vaguely suits the mood, but yeah, it doesn't add a whole lot, I feel.
Well, so we have, that's actually, so I don't know quite what I was expecting, I think, was a much faster paced action comedy, I think. Mm-hmm. And this is quite, considering, I mean, I haven't seen the film before, but I know the premise, which is basically there are the establishment, it's not just us and them. The them in this case are aliens from another planet. You've come to inflict capitalism upon the world until it's, they're basically neoliberals who are trying to destroy the planet. Yeah. I know it seems like a quaint idea now. Such a thing would never happen in modern times, but in the 80s that was a big worry.
Well, at least they're not Japanese this time, you know.
we're looking at you, the Phantom Menace, goodness me. The premise is solid and it's interesting, but it takes a long time to get there. So he gets a job. He meets the wonderful Keith David, who always enlivens any film he's ever in. That he is
we've seen in two previous Remnant Meme films. The thing he is, he's in Platoon as King. So
oh, of course he is. Yes, yeah, he's great whenever we see him. And he's sort of always Keith David. But that's fine by me.
Yep. And as it's set up to start with, he is saying, yeah, things are going to pot. You got to try to do something about it, or they'll just keep taking until you've got nothing left. And our hero, who is nameless in the film, but he's credited as Nada, basically saying, well, that's great for you, but I just want to do my work, get paid, move on to the next place, don't want to get involved.
Yes, he's not exactly happy-go-lucky because he's not happy or particularly lucky.
But, but he does go.
He does go. He's sort of laid back and kind of resigned to his place in a way that actually a lot of the other characters are kind of angry about it all. But then we have this quite prolonged setup that there's the TV is being interrupted by desperate kind of academic-looking type who's saying they are using you don't know what's happening, it's all behind the scenes.
I'm particularly fond of one of the lines, racial justice and human rights are non-existent, and my view from the 2020s, oh you sweet summer child.
Oh, let's not dwell on reality, it's too depressing. So it takes a while to get going because there's a lot of this, and there's quite a lot of Roddy Piper standing looking at things, I felt.
Or walking looking at things.
Walking looking at things, standing looking at things with a, I don't want to do him injustice, but with a similar expression on his face in most, now it's a suitable expression, which is a kind of bemused, slightly quizzical, slightly interested, but it's a lot of it.
The way I felt is that basically there is one really good sequence in this film, which is when he finally gets hold of the magic sunglasses that let you see the aliens and indeed the aliens' subliminal messages, and he's walking around seeing them.
That's incredible.
Great. Also 40% of the way into the film and it only lasts a few minutes.
Yeah. I mean, the problem, knowing the premise going in, it's like a slow build-up to something I already know is happening, which is perhaps uncharitable to the film, but I feel like you probably would, even in the 80s, would you know the idea going into the film?
Well, the poster has a close-up of Roddy's face, one lens of the sunglasses, and one of the aliens reflected in that lens. So you could possibly guess, at least.
I think a fair chunk of the audience has got some idea that when you put these sunglasses on, you actually... it's quite a Lovecraftian idea, really. It's kind of a blend of Lovecraftian and capitalism, because the aliens are not unknowable, dark beings from beyond the... They're basically neoliberal
Well, as one of the characters puts it, we are their third world. They're coming in, they're taking what they can get, and once it's all used up, they'll happily move on.
So it's... I guess you could say a lot of it's social commentary, but I'm not sure it's saying anything new or desperately interesting.
Well, it wasn't a mainstream thing in the 80s, to be fair. I mean, yes, there were people saying it, but it wasn't a thing you could find on, you know, half the podcasts in the world, for obvious reasons. But, yeah.
Mainly because there weren't podcasts.
Well, yes. There are some good bits other than that. Our hero winds up at an encampment for homeless people, and the police, for no obvious reason, suddenly decide they're going to come in with the bulldozers and smash everything up.
That's where he turns from sort of a passive observer into a protagonist, in a way that he makes a choice to align himself with the homeless. He could have just walked away, but he does sort of make a choice to align himself to try and rescue someone, and then he becomes involved.
But the police are basically doing a sweep. They are. It's odd because it's clearly meant to be they are arresting everybody, and those people are never going to be seen again. And yet, during the initial assault, you've got this line of policemen marching forward, and the homeless people who don't choose to fight them, who just duck between them and run away, don't get chased. So.
Exactly. Yeah. Piper's character could have just walked off, but he almost does, but he doesn't.
But anyway, and it's this, this is really a sideshow, because the encampment is just across the road from a church, and it is at
that church.
Which
he's already sort of explored at some point, and I think, oh, he's going to find the sunglasses now, but he doesn't. It's got a long sequence where he just finds something unusual going on.
He sees the really... Okay, so... This is one of those self-defeating camouflage things. So the church comes to his attention in the first place because there is a choir practicing, even quite late at night.
Yes.
And on his first trip into the church, he sees that, yes, this is in fact a tape and a PA system. So why not just turn the tape off at times that are not plausible for choir practice? I mean, churches are often not full of people.
Not every church is all quiet all the time, I gather.
So in my headcanon, this is how the aliens found out that was where it was. But anyway.
So they forgot to press stop.
Mm.
But yes, then he gets into the church, takes a box and finds it's full of sunglasses. Even then, he takes a while to put them on.
My impression is he's thinking, well, why on earth are there sunglasses here? This makes no sense.
But he
takes a box, presumably in the hope that he might be able to sell it or something of that nature.
Yes, and stores them somewhere, puts on the sunglasses, and then, yes, we have this incredible sequence where every billboard and every book cover and everything is obey, procreate, spend... Do all the things you're supposed to do. Be a good capitalist. And I absolutely agree. That is a standout sequence. Unfortunately, I'd seen that sequence before. Because that is
it's the one everybody's going to quote, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, to be fair, in terms of practical effects, the insult on the encampment is well mounted. You know, they've obviously they've got a relatively small budget, but they use it well.
Yes.
And that's actually a very good sequence. The problem is it doesn't really mean much in terms of the film.
I find that in a few of these scenes, actually. So then it sort of explains it later, but from being this very passive, fairly relaxed guy who has done the odd bit of heroic, he then turns into this kind of kick-ass 80s superhero character.
Well, you could vaguely claim respectability for quoting the hero's journey still at this point.
But he doesn't, I don't know that he earns it. Now, later on, he says, oh, these sunglasses give you quite a high. So I assume that's why we have a kind of personality change. But he then, like, stomps into on the basis that a lot of people are aliens, he starts sort of beating them up and killing them without really knowing quite what's going on. It didn't really sell that to me. I sort of like the idea that, you know, from the outside, he could actually be insane and he's just murdering people randomly. But he kicks his way into a bank. He says the famous quip that I started the podcast with, that everyone knows. It's a weird delivery, though, I have to say, of a very good quip. And then starts killing off these aliens. I love the alien makeup is really cool, actually. The way their mouths move. They're obviously just kind of rubber masks, but they're interesting faces.
And effectively used because, I mean, one of the things that's, it's a trick that's done several times, but it works, is, you know, we look at them with the sunglasses and they are just talking to apparent humans in an entirely normal way. But because you can see them being aliens, you're thinking, okay, is this alien actually trying to send us a subliminal message here along with the other stuff they're saying?
Yes.
And that works really quite well.
Is that a kind of banal conversation also, some kind of mind programming? Yeah.
Mm. So, yeah, he puts on the glasses and he loses any shred of subtlety.
Yes, I mean, think that's
to be fair, some of that is because he started off being, wow, you're ugly. And the aliens are not entirely stupid, so one of them calls in, we've got one who can see us here.
Yes.
I mean, unfortunately, so because of the budget, they only mobilised the LAPD rather than the entire world's armed forces.
Well, we have a helicopter flight, but I find that slightly sad in a way that it dispels any idea that he might be just hallucinating and imagining it all. They are actually there, but that's fine. It's that kind of action film.
So he runs away. People come after him. He kills them. He runs away some more.
Well, no, he kills the aliens. He doesn't kill any people, as far as we know.
Yeah.
But yes.
In spite of having a shotgun. So, yeah, and then he, in order to get out of a trap, takes a woman hostage.
It put me in mind of in Commando. Schwarzenegger does the same thing.
Yeah.
I feel like Schwarzenegger manages to do it less creepily and scarily. I don't know. I mean, in neither situation is it a good thing.
He eventually, she's going along with the whole thing and saying, look, okay, whatever you want, I'm going to agree with whatever you say. I don't want to die, etc. She doesn't put on, I think she doesn't put on the glasses at this point, but she does give him a nice whack around the back of the head and throw him out of her window.
That's nicely done, scene as well. But she has got the sunglasses.
He leaves them behind because they got knocked off during the fight.
Presumably, she might put them on at some point. Hmm. He goes back, finds the sunglasses where he kept them. There's a scene where he has to climb into a trash.
Yeah,
that's
just a weird thing. I mean, okay. It's not a compactor, and in the UK, compactors are pretty much universal.
Yes. So I thought he's in real trouble here.
But here's the weird thing. Assume the crew of the vehicle don't know what he's doing. What they're doing is that there's this horizontal cylinder that they're shoveling all the trash into. They close the hatch. They raise it to near vertical. And then they drive off with the thing near vertical. Why don't they just drive off with it horizontal? I mean,
it seemed to be the film is full of kind of, well, not full of, but there seems to be a number of scenes like this that are just a little pointless complication that it's almost like playing for time. Like,
I mean,
he's only a few yards from where he found the sunglasses anyway. It doesn't really add any danger to him because it's not a compactor and he just sort of punches his way back out again. So I'm not.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fun bit of action, but it doesn't mean anything, and perhaps we're being too demanding here, but...
We are, but there's not really a lot of peril. Similarly, there's then a protracted sequence where he gets trying to get Keith David to put the sunglasses on, and it's... if you're into wrestling, then I guess that's quite a fun fight scene, and a great fight scene to watch and really enjoy. To me, I found it a frustrating scene.
Yeah, even I, who am not particularly a wrestling fan, wrote down, can't resist showing off a few wrestling moves, can you?
It seemed to be there just because he's a wrestler and here's some wrestling.
And Keith David makes a pretty good job of it too.
Oh yeah, it's a really well orchestrated scene. But the stakes in this scene, you know, we've talked about, you know, what we like in action, so what we like in films is what's the environment, what's happening, what's the stakes going in, what could they lose? And the actual fight and the choreography is amazing, but the stakes are you're going to put on some sunglasses, and you kind of know he's going to do that at some point. So it's like a
And why is he so resistant to the point of beating up one of the few friends he has?
Yeah, it feels...
Why doesn't he say, okay, I'll try a bomb, 30 seconds, whatever.
A little like the trash can thing. It's a complication that seems to drag it out. For a sort of an 8 minute, it's a long fight scene, and it has like several, like little, it's like in three parts even, that you almost think he's done. And then it starts off again, and then it starts off again. I guess if I was into wrestling and I went to see Roddy Piper because he's a wrestler, and I'd be like, yeah, here's the wrestling scene, I would have loved it.
I mean, if you've heard the name going in to see this film in 1998, then you probably know him as a wrestler.
But even, you know, Schwarzenegger didn't... I guess there are moments where he poses and shows off his muscles quite a lot, but they're not so gratuitous.
Well, he's a wrestler, he's not a bodybuilder. I mean, obviously
well,
there's some
true.
Overlap, but...
The closest I can think of is in Predator, where they both, like, grab hands, and he's like, Dylan, you son of a bitch, and there's this huge bicep off, and it's clear that, that Schwarzenegger has got quite an impressive physique. But it's, you know, that's a 3 second shot, not a 8 minute fight scene.
Yeah. And so eventually he gets back to the church where they've set up again, because obviously, you know, having raided it, the police will never come back here. I assume that's the thinking.
They've done it once, they can't do it again.
There is a resistance meeting. The woman he kidnapped turns up saying, I wore the glasses, it's all true. Holly, that's her name.
I wonder if Carpenter's got a thing about women with green eyes, because she's got striking sort of pale green eyes.
Well, I'll come back to her. This is Meg Foster. But anyway, they go in, they're saying, they're having the usual resistance type arguments, you know, do we go on trying to build up our strength and recruiting, because we're not recruiting that well, or do we go with the forces we've got and start the revolution now? And there is argument, and there is a police raid. And
yes.
Given how difficult it was for Roddy to get in, you know, I mean, I'm assuming that 20% of the people in there are police spies, but maybe that's just me.
well, it turns out
we have established there are humans collaborating with the aliens. That has been mentioned.
Yes. So we, I mean, this again, it's a cool fight sequence. Like, well, it starts with a bang, the whole wall explodes, and
but it's very dark.
Yeah.
I mean, Precinct 18. It was also very dark, but I found that much more exciting. And here it was just, here is a long sequence with gunshots and explosions, and who are the people? What are they doing?
Well, I think they're
running around
for
in circles and dying.
In a lot of these scenes, the stakes, it's not that they're low, it's just, you can't see how the scene's going to end out differently. It's not like...
Some of that may be trying to do a big scene on a low budget, whereas Precinct 13, we've got relatively few people in any given shot, which obviously makes it cheaper.
We know them all, we like them all, and we're desperate for them to survive or see what happens. Whereas here, we don't know most of the people, so a lot of them just fall over, they die. We think it's unlikely that either Keith David or Roddy Piper or Meg Foster are going to die. So they all escape.
Mm-hmm.
But then they jump into a hole in the floor.
I mean, to be fair, again, we've already established that the aliens have this emergency teleport tech.
Mm. But it takes them right, like, to the centre of the, at least in LA, presumably, their whole operation in LA. And from that point...
Yeah, from a security point of view, this is what's known as the eggshell theory. You've got a very hard shell and then absolutely no security inside it.
Yeah.
And you absolutely trust that shell. And so all it needs is one failure and then your bad guys are running around inside your invasion base.
Well, but the failure is they kill an alien and take his watch. And that's all they need to do. And then they're in. And then from that point on, as you say, no one quite, even though they look out of place and confused and they're not wearing the right clothes, no one's like, hang on. Everyone's like, oh yeah, okay, welcome for coming over to the right side. The sort of a
formal
meal.
Come to the world domination banquet.
the foreman from very early on in the film turns up and he's like, hey boys, you decided to join in. And I like that sequence. It's fun where he's sort of showing that. But then he's like, let me show you to the central headquarters of the whole place. Are they carrying guns at this point? I think they are. No, maybe they...
Well, they've got guns. I think they're concealing them.
And then they run up to the top of the building.
having established that there is this constant signal to keep the reality suppression field going.
Yes, the thing that the sunglasses nullify. Then we quickly have Keith David dispatched because we find out Meg Foster, is it Holly?
Yeah.
Is indeed a traitor and not... It did slightly surprise me because it had established quite well, oh yeah, well, she probably looked at the glasses and this is why she's turned up. I was slightly surprised that she turned out to be a traitor. And then we have this very dark ending where she also kills Roddy Piper's character. He kills her, but he manages to destroy the transmission sequence. And just at the end of it, he sees that... then we have this montage of people waking up, realizing that they're variously making love to, eating with, on a plane with these alien creatures. Well, that's it. And if we've described it very flatly, and I feel like, well, perhaps we are being a bit mean to it. I don't know. The way we've described it is similar to how I felt watching it. It was sort of one thing after another.
I mean, you can generate a narrative thing. This has happened, and therefore he goes on to do this, and therefore that other thing happens, and so on. But there are certainly sections, as we've said, like the fight, like the garbage truck, which just feel, okay, we need a bit of action here. Let's have this thing. You know, the audience has come to see Roddy throw people about, so let's have the audience seeing Roddy throw people about.
Yeah, and I feel like. We know John Carpenter can do fast-paced action comedy pretty well, because we've seen Big Trouble in Little China. But this isn't that. It's a much sort of dark, and it's not quite... I mean, it doesn't have to be the same as anything, but it doesn't quite work on... As an action film, I never felt the stakes were quite there. As a science fiction film, I don't know. There's a lot of holes in the whole idea. I don't know if it's supposed to be a comedy particularly. I think it's just like an 80s.
I don't think so, but I think Roddy thinks it is.
Yes. As a social commentary, I don't know. I think for me it just doesn't quite work as an action thriller film. In the way, you know, we had our Arnie-a-thon and we watched a lot of films. I feel like even Running Man.
And this is coming out in between those films.
Right, yeah. Oh, was it the same year as Running Man? Running Man was probably our least favourite of those films. I still felt it was an easier, quicker watch than this one, personally. I can't know, and I mentioned to you, how did you feel about Roddy Piper's acting in this one then? Or his screen presence, perhaps, is a kind of way of
thinking. I must admit that I think he is one of the things wrong with the film, because he isn't fun to watch.
He is.
You were saying you couldn't decide whether he was taciturn or just a bad actor.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, you know, the man had a multi-decade pro wrestling career, so at the very least, he ought to be able to reel off the one-liners, because, you know, that's part of the show. So presumably he could do that. I don't think Arnie could quite do this.
I feel like he can quit pretty well, Arnie.
Yeah, but
he's just got incredible screen presence and charisma, Arnie. In a similar way to, you know,
he could do that, but I don't think he could be plausibly a regular guy. Which
fair enough.
Nader is meant to be.
I think maybe
now Bruce Willis circa Die Hard would absolutely do this, and that's basically what he did in Die Hard. Yeah, the ordinary guy who has to spin up to use his.
I think having said that now, imagining Bruce Willis,
I will also put in a bid for Lance Henriksen.
He never quite got the chance to be a great leading man, did he, Lance Henriksen? But
the rumours and the details of them differ, but some variant of he was originally down to play the Terminator and then Arnie said, yeah, but
James Cameron.
Yeah, the rumours and the way it works differ, but originally it was suggested that he would be the Terminator and Arnie would be one of the other characters in the film, and it was pointed out that, you know, Arnie cannot plausibly look terrified of a man who looks like Lance Henriksen.
Yes.
Not in a way that's going to be visceral and come over on the screen.
I think Cameron resisted it because Terminator, in theory, was supposed to be a stealth unit, and he was like, "Who? Arnie is not a stealth unit." Anyway, that's a different film.
We've talked about it already, but yeah, and he doesn't grab the eye. He's not. I mean, a lot of these films, yes, all right, Arnie is being a magnet for the camera and so on, much as we see here, but he's not just a great hunk of beef. He's got that grin that makes you. Even sometimes he's suggesting, yeah, this is kind of stupid, but it's fun, isn't it? I mean, we talked about that in Commando.
There is a real sense of fun in a lot of Arnie's films that it's just, I think that's what I was missing here, the sense of...
Oh, Van Damme.
Okay, we know this is... Well, I was thinking Van Damme...
He could also do this.
I was going to say Dolph Lundgren, probably... Well,
not so much.
Probably a similar thing. But any of those... I mean, you could even have someone like, Chuck Norris could probably do a similar...
I haven't seen him, but yeah.
Well, he's now the captain of the internet, isn't he, Chuck Norris? But I think a sense of fun is what I was missing here. You know, Big Trouble in Little China, the whole thing is tongue-in-cheek. I feel this could have done with a bit more... It is essentially ridiculous, and it's a satire, really. I mean, I know a satire is some way... Sometimes you call something that's failed as a comedy, oh, well, it was a satire. That's how I feel about a lot of satire. But it is essentially a kind of satire on consumerism and capitalism. From the quote that I knew that I came here to kick ass and chew bubblegum, I felt like, oh, it's going to be one of those kind of films. And that quote is kind of out of place of the rest of it because it's not really like that, the rest of it.
They're already terrified of you because you're in a bank with a shotgun. You don't need to terrify them further.
A lot of these are normal people. I mean, it would have worked better at the end. It didn't gel with me. I don't want to rail on it. I know we have some very good friends who love it.
Yeah. I've seen Meg Foster in two things that were good, and this is one of them.
Okay.
So possibly I should make that one and a half things that were good. But the same year as this, Leviathan came out. And we may look at that one day. Underwater adventure. It's basically Alien in a Submarine, but it's slightly cleverer than that.
It rings a bell, yes.
And she has a small part in that as the corporate boss who appears on video link to say, basically, everything's fine, don't worry, rescue ship's on the way. But sadly, the storm is stopping us getting you out. And
the Carter Burke character,
and gets punched in the face at the end when they've survived. But I looked up her career because I think of her as a person I'd like to see because she is great in that. She's pretty good here, but it's a small part. Sadly, she the year before she was in Masters of the Universe, and let's face it, nobody who was in Masters of the Universe did a terribly good job. I don't know why.
Oh God, is she Evil Lynn?
Yeah.
CME.
And the year after this, she was in Blind Fury, which is basically...
I love that. That might be a film where I had a similar experience. If I went back and watched that now, I'd be like, that was terrible. But in the 80s,
but basically, Rutger Hauer is a blind veteran who has been taught amazing martial arts by a Vietnamese master when he was a prisoner of war. And now he goes around doing good. And she is the... I think wife of the old buddy he's trying to rescue, and so there's child bonding moments and stuff like that. But
I'm interested how
most of her career, to be fair, was TV parts in the 60s and 70s, and she didn't have a lot of film work. But I always think she's one of those actors who does the best with what they're given at the very least.
I felt she was a little flat here. I felt like I got the most emotion from Keith David.
Yeah.
In this film, he's very good at being kind of angry, and
I won't say he's necessarily the best actor, but he is certainly doing the best acting job that we see here. I think
it's got the most kind of energy. How did you feel? Can you remember how you felt about it in the 80s? You loved it.
I didn't see it when it came out, but I think I saw it in the 90s, probably on video rental or something of that nature. And yeah, I mean, action film, yay, great, kicking ass. Yeah. I was not particularly aware of subtlety of acting here. The other thing that has soured a bit for me, and this may be affecting my feeling on the film, is that in the late 80s and even through the 90s, conspiracy theories were considered basically harmless, you know.
Yeah.
A nutter would claim a thing, and maybe they would get a few other people to agree with them, but it did not take off on any sort of large scale. And these days, there is a lot more blatant conspiracy theory that is widely believed, like anti-vaxxing. And I, maybe it's just me, maybe I've got better at finding it, but it feels that the number of layers between the harmless conspiracy theory and therefore we need to kill all the Jews has got fewer.
Yeah. I think that's, yeah, that might be why it feels a bit uncomfortable as well. I think that is fair to say.
So somebody did come along, basically say, yay, this film is clearly a coded message about the Jews. We should all praise it because of that, sometime in about 2010. And Carpenter obviously said, no!
Well, he had a similar thing not similar, but in Halloween, everyone said it was a judgment on sexual behaviour in teenagers. Like, no, I was making them behave like teenagers.
But the fact that it is that easy to link it across does suggest that, yeah, the background that we're living in has changed enough that I feel a little edgy about that now.
Yeah, from the point of view of our current dystopia, yes, it seems less harmless than it did. I think that's fair, kind of retroactive criticism of it, which is not the film's fault at the time.
And yeah, but it contributed to my enjoying it a bit less this time round, so.
Fair enough.
Which is a shame, because, yeah, I did love this film. I went into it thinking, yeah, this is a film I love, and then it wasn't.
Yeah, so. Surprise misfire for me, too. I think we've explained why. I still love John Carpenter. I still love that he tries all these very different things. And I'm sure we'll watch more of them. Mm. I didn't dislike it as much as I disliked Halloween. So I didn't not like it. It's just, yeah, that happened. And I just feel it could have been better, which we shouldn't criticise it for. But
yeah, I'm just thinking about timing, though, because this is 88, and so is Leviathan, which we may talk about someday, but the short version is I quite like it. Yeah, 1986, we've got Aliens, Big Trouble in Little China. 87, we've got Full Metal Jacket, Predator, Robocop, The Running Man.
A lot of these we've watched.
This year we've got... I'm just looking at the list of films we have actually treated.
Oh, okay.
This year we've got Die Hard. 89, we've got Back to the Future 2 and Heathers. You know, there are a lot of really good films coming out at this date.
Yeah.
And it's a period that I at least take fondly, but...
Yeah.
Mm.
I feel like, I must admit, reading that list, I can't deny this would be my least favourite of every one of those films you mentioned.
Still. It has
but
its
there
moments.
We are.
I wouldn't
it's
suggest
not, it's
avoiding
not a terrible
it, but,
film.
Yeah.
For me, not a masterpiece for the record, but I think we've cleared that up already. But there we are. A surprise, maybe it just wasn't quite what we were expecting, but it's interesting you had a similar experience and you've seen it before, but there we are.
And I think it only remains to say there is no America, there is no, oh no, hang on, that's a different film. White Lines in the Middle of the Road, that's the worst place to drive.
Good afternoon, Rod.